Welcome to the Penguin Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Penguin Podcast. I'm Kevin Bridges. This week, we're looking at funny people. I'm a funny person, in my own humble opinion, and here's some more. And I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to the Penguin Podcast. Yes, the days are shorter, temperatures have dropped, indicating that winter has well and truly arrived, but we don't think that there's any reason to imagine things have turned bleak. Christmas is right around the corner, and we're going to lift everyone's spirits as the countdown begins with our funniest books of the year. Scottish comedian Kevin Bridges takes to the stage first as he tells us about his mischief-making from his book We Need to Talk About Kevin Bridges.
As soon as I'd hung up, the shouts would come to do another one. Everyone scrambling through their mobile phone contacts, looking for numbers. Opposite Halpin's house, there was a takeaway called Frank's. What gave Frank's its appeal for a prank call was that the owner had a hilariously short temper. I'd wound him up before, and we'd formed a Mo Sizzlack, Bart Simpson relationship with each other. From Halpin's living room window, we could see right into the shop, so we could watch the guy, live, losing his shit. It was a prank call first. His nickname became Frank the Wank, and then Frank the Fruitcake, on account of how easily he'd snap and start shouting threats. Oh, do you think you're a hard man, hiding behind the phone, eh? The sheer venom in his voice would make it difficult not to laugh. I was becoming fascinated with people who could take themselves this seriously. We went down Halpin stairs and into his living room. His mum and dad were both at work. I dialed the number and we watched Frank the Fruitcake shaking the chips about in the fryer, wiping his hands and walking towards the shop phone. Get it on loudspeaker. Jamie, Halpin and Doc were whispering, covering their mouths again. Any laughter would ruin what had the potential to be a groundbreaking prank call. I was aware that he might know my voice from previous wind-ups, from when Tony and I would phone to noise him up. This was big time now though. The art form of the prank call had evolved since then. I changed my voice to a deeper, more serious-sounding, mature voice, like the ones I'd heard on the bus to college in the mornings, from people living in Bearsden and Mogai, the more middle-class areas between Clybank and the city centre.
Yeah, listen, I just popped in for lunch there in my taxi. I opened up my sausage supper, and well, I'm afraid to say the chips didn't appear to be cooked thoroughly.
That was all it took for Frank the Fruitcake to have one of his meltdowns. As demons came rushing out, the red mist had descended.
Well, why did you no say anything at the fucking time then?
Unbelievable. One fairly trivial complaint from a polite enough voice, and I'd got him swearing at the customer.
Are you swearing? Are you swearing at me?
I asked, trying to sound thoroughly outraged.
Look, mate, fuck off. If there's a problem with the food, then you come down to the shop.
He'd finished and was about to put the phone down. I had to be quick, or this was an opportunity wasted.
That's it, I'm on my way down there. Fuck you, mate. We'll sort this out like men.
I said, changing my voice to try and match his menacing tone.
I'll be right here waiting. Come ahead. Come a fucking head.
He was screaming at me now.
Black taxi, mate. I'll be outside in 5 minutes.
I hung up. It hadn't been the most creative prank call, although the sheer abuse and aggression from Frank the Fruitcake had ensured the hilarity. But I had a twist. I phoned a local taxi number. I didn't bother with the loudspeaker, since Jamie, Halpin and Doc would hear all that was important.
Hi, could I have a taxi, please?
Yeah, Frank's.
Yeah, as soon as possible. Thank you, bye.
I then phoned Frank back.
That's me on the way. We'll see who's the big man now.
The three of them began pissing themselves, but in shocked realisation of what had just been set up. Everyone was now clamouring for a space at Halpin's living room window to get the best view. I immediately felt terrible, thinking of the worst possible outcome. Images of violence flashing in my head. Anything could be about to happen. An innocent taxi driver showing up, whistling, parking outside Frank's, tooting his horn, patiently browsing the back page of his paper, and then suddenly being dragged out of his cab and beaten to a pulp by a crazed, lunatic chip shop owner. A few taxis passed, but none were ours. All three of us must have looked away from the shop at the same time, because we heard the horn first, which made us instantly return our focus to Frank's. I felt even worse now that the poor guy had given a little playful toot of his horn. He'd done a little tune. It wasn't the sound of a man who was down to settle a score. I went to grab my phone, to phone Frank, and let him know I was a 16-year-old boy showing off in front of his friends, but it was too late. Frank was out on the pavement, accompanied by two of his staff. Frank himself was quite small, a definite case of little man syndrome, but his workers looked as fierce as he sounded. They stood at the passenger side window, talking to the driver for a few minutes. I was glad they were appearing to ask questions first. Hopefully it would become apparent to all parties that this was a misunderstanding. They spoke for about 2 minutes in total before the taxi drove off, the driver obviously explaining that he didn't know what was going on. He'd just received a call to pick up a hire at Frank's, and Frank hadn't recognised him from being in the shop buying a sausage supper earlier. There had been a few flaws in my idea, thankfully. Frank and his two henchmen returned to the shop. I was relieved. I was pumping with adrenaline after thinking I was about to be the cause of a brutal attack. Frank obviously wasn't as psychotic as his telephone demeanour suggested, so that was good. I phoned him back to round it all off. He answered, clearly a little pissed off, but above all, confused. I simply whispered, "Shitebag." I held up the phone again, letting him hear how much entertainment he'd provided in Halpin's living room.
"You again. Fuck you. If I ever find out who this is, I'm going to rip your spine out and poke your ass."
Kevin Bridges and a prank call. Fancy another one? All right then.
I'd pretend to be a furious father and phone the lost property department of a local nightclub on behalf of my teenage daughter.
"Okay, can you just calm down, please, sir? What exactly is it that she's lost?"
I'd look at Jamie, Halpin and Doc, all covering their mouths and trying not to laugh as I had the guy by the balls.
"Her virginity. She has lost her virginity."
We'd have the manager on loudspeaker asking,
"What the fuck do you want me to do about that then, mate?"
Which suggested he wasn't skilled in the field of customer service. The customer is always right, unless the company is a money laundering front for gangland activity.
"I'll be coming down there to get it back, or I'll be taking yours,"
I'd conclude, proudly holding up the phone to hear him return fire, an incoherent volley of abuse. This was the cue for Jamie, Halpin and Doc to stop suppressing their laughter. They'd erupt, letting the guy know it was a wind-up.
Two extracts from Kevin Bridges' book, We Need to Talk About Kevin Bridges. Another stand-up comedian to grace this year's Penguin roster of authors is David O'Doherty with his hilarious survival guide for children entitled Danger is Everywhere. Under the guise of Dr. Noel Zone, David raises children's awareness of the fact that danger is lurking behind every corner. Safety can never be guaranteed, particularly, it seems, at Christmas.
Hello, my name is David, and this is...
My name is Chris.
And we have written Danger is Everywhere. Well, I've written it, and Chris has done the pictures. And as our Christmas gift to you, we present the dangers of Christmas. So could we put on some Christmassy music and we'll begin. Danger one, sure, decorate your house. Get a Christmas tree. Just make sure you don't get a Christmas tree with chimps living in it. Chimps are notorious Christmas ruiners. You can't play a board game with chimps. You can't have a meal with chimps. If you try and watch a movie, well, they'll only want to watch movies with monkeys in them. You know, King Kong, Planet of the Apes, Dunstan Checks In. And presents, you get the worst presents. It's always the same from chimps. What did you get me? Oh, let me guess. It's this chip. Oh, it's a banana. Ugh. Chimps. Holly is much too dangerous to have hanging around your house. It's just too pointy. No, instead, why not hang up just bunches of grass? You can't injure yourself with grass. Although the problem with grass is that cows could hear that there's a lot of grass in your house, and then they'll try to get in. Sometimes a whole herd of cows will pose as carol singers. So if you open your door and they're singing, but you hear just the word moo, 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 pull their hats off. You're like, oh, you're cows, you're not getting in. And well, the chimps sometimes let the cows in. Chimps and cows. The most important question to ask Santa were you to meet Santa is, how can I be sure you are Santa and not a werewolf? Because they're both, you know, big and hairy, but you don't want to mix them up. Ugh. Dangerous Christmas presents include an elephant, a jet ski, an elephant on a jet ski, a cat. Pets are a bad idea for a Christmas present, but particularly like a kitten. How can you be sure it's not a baby tiger? Mistletoe. People stand under mistletoe waiting for a kiss. And if you give them a kiss, yeah, what happens if that person is a vampire? And then when you go to give them a kiss, they chomp. Ooh. Say no to mistletoe. Christmas crackers? Really? Do you want to invite an explosion to Christmas? If you really feel you have to do Christmas crackers, well, you have to fill the bath first and then pull them with the other person underwater. Because then instead of going, they'll go, psst. Don't open Christmas cards from ghosts. Because if you open it and it's from a ghost, the ghost could fly out of the envelope and start haunting your house. No, the way to check if a Christmas card is from a ghost is look at the address on the front. If it's your address, that's fine. But if the address written there is woo, 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 that is definitely from a ghost. By all means, get an angel for the top of your Christmas tree. Don't get an eagle. Eagles fly everywhere. They poop everywhere. You try and eat your turkey and the eagle will be like, no, turkey is my friend, or really, really angry. So long as you remember about chimps, cows, werewolves, tigers, vampires, crackers, ghosts, and eagles, then you will have a happy and a not dangerous at all Christmas.
An exclusive clip from David O'Doherty, author of Danger Is Everywhere, on the dangers at Christmas. Take care this festive period. You're listening to the Penguin Podcast. Comedian Dave Gorman thinks we're suffering from information overload and wonders in his new book, Too Much Information, how much we really pay attention to. During the production of his audiobook, we asked him a couple of questions about how he found the recording experience and the difference between writing a book and writing stand-up.
Writing a book is so much different to writing stand-up or for other projects. In one huge way, it's the only part of writing that actually gets written down for me. I've never written a script for a stage show or anything like that. And I think this is true for a lot of comics. You go on stage and you've got some ideas and you say them, and the next night you say them again. And anything that worked the night before, you kind of keep. And anything that didn't, you kind of change. And you're not even thinking about that. That's just a natural process of in which your material evolves and gets polished up. And you think about it and you kind of write a little note on a card somewhere, but you never write it word for word. And I think as an audience member, you don't want to hear it and have it sound like someone is delivering a script. You want to have it sound like it has a natural intonation and a natural flow to it. And the way of achieving that best is to never have written a script and never to have learnt it. What you're trying to do is learn what is the nub of the joke and how do I best communicate it to this audience tonight. So you just never write things down, or at least I don't. And then with a book, I've discovered there is no way of not writing it down with a book. There's something about having to have a book at the end, which has words on it, that means you have to have thought of all those words and have put them in the right order yourself. So that's the only time I do. And then it's a kind of, well, it's obviously a completely different process. Also, the feedback loop is much longer. On stage, you're talking and you know whether that audience is engaged in what you're doing immediately. And that is true on TV and in radio because there's always a live audience there with the things I do. And with a book, there's always that nervousness as you send it out into the big wide world. And you wrote it several months ago by the time real people are reading it. And so your feedback loop is really long and really weird and you can't change it. So you sweat over every word. And what you're trying to do, I think, is to In my head, I'm thinking, let's sit by a fireside and I'll read to you. I want you to read the words on the page and imagine I'm reading them to you rather than chatting to you or performing to you. There is a slight different tone of voice. So you're just trying to achieve that, I think.
How does the experience of reading an audiobook differ from stand-up or radio shows, especially when you don't have a live audience?
Reading an audiobook, it's a very different thing. For a start, I don't like the sound of my own voice, and most of your life you don't spend listening to your own voice, and this is a weird thing, so obviously I hear things back and I have to think about it. So that's an awkward and weird thing to me. But the main difference is just that lack of an audience. But then it's not the same kind of performance either. If you're performing to an audience, you're looking them in the eye and they're in the same room as you. And when someone's listening to an audiobook, they're not in the same room as you and they're not looking at you and their level of expectation is different and the whole tone is different. And you just have to get comfortable with that and accept that this relationship happens long distance, both sort of actually physically, but also metaphorically, in that it's you're in their ears, you're taking over their brain, and hopefully they immerse themselves in it. And someone who's in an audience doesn't let you into their brain, they watch you and they share it with all these other people who are around them. And so where they are right now is in a theatre. And they don't ever, during that night, think, God, it was like I wasn't in the theatre. It was exactly like you were in the theatre. It was really live. It was really up front. And hopefully when someone's listening to the book, at some point, they're not in their living room or they're not in their bedroom or they're not on a train and it takes them out of that place. And that's a really different thing because in a theatre or with any live audience, it's about the here and now. And in an audiobook, it's not about the here and now. It's about closing out a bit of the here and now and immersing yourself in something different. And if you get that into your head, then reading the book and hating the sound of your own voice suddenly becomes okay.
Now, on to the authors that have turned humour into a literary art form. The much-loved author Sue Townsend is a British household name, and her love-anguished hero, Adrian Mole, has been a hilarious companion to many. In the wilderness years, Adrian, aged 23 3/4, receives a letter from Sharon Bott revealing the outcome of a brief and dispassionate affair. In his diary, he writes,
Saturday, June 1st. Two letters. One from Plums, offering me a set of matching towels with my personal monogram embroidered on the hems. The other from Sharon Bott. Dear Adrian, I hope you are well. Long time no see. I saw your mum in town and we had a talk. She said how much Glenn looks like you. I said yes and she said, is he our Adrian, Sharon? I must know. She came out with it just like that. I didn't know what to say. I've got to confess I was seeing somebody else at the time as I was seeing you and I didn't want to double time you, Adrian, but sometimes you was moody and I wanted some laughs. I was only young. Glenn is going to school now and is a big boy. My mum says you should pay money, but I said no, Mum, it would not be fair because I don't know if Glenn is Adrian's or not. Your mum gave me this address to write to you. I hope there is not too many spelling mistakes, but I never write anything now since I left school. There is no need. I saw Baz on the telly, did you? He has done all right for himself. I've not got a bloke now since Darryl run off with a video and £35 I'd save for the gas. I've put on a bit of weight, but I'm going to Weight Watchers to get it off. Your mum said she would babysit. She is so good to me. Cheers, Sharon. Sunday, June 2nd. I spoke to my mother this morning and ordered her to keep her nose out of my affairs. She said, Glenn is the result of one of your affairs, and put the phone down. From then on, I got the engaged signal. I was enraged by my mother's interference. How dare she pontificate on anybody's morals? I know for a fact that she was not a virgin on her wedding night. Grandma told me. And anyway, my mother should not have spoken in the plural. I have not had affairs. I had an affair. In the singular. With Sharon Bott, a simpleton who cannot differentiate between there, and there, and is a virtual stranger to the comma and full stop. She probably thinks that a semicolon is a partial removal of the intestines. Memo to self. Is the kid mine? Blood test? Letter of denial? 2 a.m. Wrote to Sharon. 3 a.m. Destroyed the letter. My reply to her must be carefully crafted. I need time to read up on the law relating to paternity. Tuesday, June 4th. Thank God, Prince William has made a full recovery after being bashed on the head by a golf club. When I think how close we came to losing our future king, my heart stands still. Well, not literally still. It doesn't stop, but I'm glad the kid is better. I phoned Grandma in Leicester. She wanted to know why Prince Charles didn't pick his son up from the hospital. She said, "Doesn't he know that it's tradition in our English culture?" She thinks that the monarchy is losing touch with the common herd, and she complained bitterly that the royal yacht Britannia cost £35,000 a week to run. 5 p.m. The Oxford Mail has just informed me that the Emir of Kuwait has yet to announce the date for democratic elections to be held in this country. Puzzling considering all the trouble and expense the Allies went to only recently. Get a move on, Emir. I'm also informed by the Oxford Mail that the Royal Yacht Britannia cost £35,000 a day. A day! I phoned Grandma immediately and put her right. She was disgusted. Query: why does the Emir of Kuwait spell his name with a small e? Friday, June 7th. I spent the morning writing a report on a projection of newt births and the early afternoon on a report of the distribution of badgers. But I fear some of the paperwork has got mixed up. As I was photocopying the reports, I noticed that I had muddled a few facts. However, Brown was shouting down the corridor for the report, so what could I do? His management meeting was due to start at 4 p.m, so I had no choice but to hand him the papers. Saturday, June 8th. Wrote to Sharon. Dear Sharon, how very nice to hear from you after all this time. I'm afraid there is no chance at all that I can be the father of your child, Glenn. I have recently had my sperm counted and I was informed by the consultant spermatologist that my sperms are too weak to transform themselves into a child. This is a personal tragedy to me as I had planned on having at least 6 children. You mentioned in your letter that you were double-timing me. I was most upset to read this. Our relationship was not ideal. I know, we came from different backgrounds. Me, upper working, lower middle. You, lower working, underclass. And of course, our educational attainments were worlds apart, not to mention our cultural interests. But despite these differences, I had thought that we rubbed along quite well sexually. I see absolutely no reason why you should have betrayed me and sought another sexual partner. I confess that I'm devastated by your revelation. I feel cheap and used. I would be most obliged to you if you would stop seeing my mother. She is addicted to human dramas of any kind. She thinks of herself as a character in a soap opera. I suggest that you should go to Weight Watchers, not WAIT Watchers, by the way, and hire yourself a competent childminder. My mother is not to be trusted with young children. She dropped me on my head at the age of 6 months while taking a boiled egg out of the saucepan. Anyway, Sharon, it was nice to hear from you. Regards, Adrian. P.S. Who were you double-timing me with? Not that it matters, of course. I have a constant stream of lovers since our relationship ended. It's simple curiosity on my part, but I would like to know the youth's name, though it is not in the least bit important. Don't feel obliged to let me know. I just think it may help to get it off your chest. Guilt can eat away with you, can't it? So would you please write to me and let me know the youth's name? I think you would feel better about yourself.
A reading from Adrian Mole, The Wilderness Years, by Sue Townsend. Nina Stibbe arrived on our bookshelves last year with her biographical book Love, Nina, which are the letters she sent her sister when she was a nanny in a house that entertained the huge literary names of the 1980s. This year she returned with her debut novel, Man at the Helm, where a divorcee moves to a small rural village with her 3 children. Rather than the usual warm welcoming from the neighbours, they're looked down on with disdain and scorn. But despite the prejudice they face, 2 daughters are determined to find their mother a new man.
So, we agreed that our main aim in life would be to find a new husband for our mother, not only for her happiness, but to keep ourselves from being made wards of the court and ending up in the Crescent homes. We were realistic about it. We didn't expect her to be going out with a new man every week. We knew the dating game was tricky. We'd read enough magazines. We decided we'd contact, by letter, every suitable man in the area and invite them in to have a drink with her and hope that it would lead to sexual intercourse and possibly marriage, obviously one at a time. And here they are. This is the children. This is following a visit from the first man on the list, Mr. Lomax, the Liberal candidate. In the post-mortem following Mr. Lomax's visit, my sister and I were self-critical, and rightly so. Our aim had been that they should have a drink and then have sex in her sitting room and do it enough times until they got engaged and then married. But we'd let him slip through our fingers with bad planning and shoddy execution. And though we agreed that Mr. Lomax wasn't the ideal, we evaluated our efforts as if he had been, even though he definitely wasn't. It had been a mistake, we agreed, not to have offered any snacks or put on any music. And this might have led to Mr. Lomax feeling uncomfortable, and probably peckish. And if there's one thing I knew for definite about men, it was that they cannot perform sex if hungry. We also agreed that doing the play had only made things worse, and it wasn't surprising that it freaked him out. We didn't let it put us off, though. My sister consulted the man list and crossed off Mr. Lomax and added Bernard, our father's chauffeur. I objected, saying that he and our mother hated each other's guts, but my sister mentioned the very fine line between love and hate, i.e. that you're more likely to want to have sex with and marry somebody you hate than someone you don't care one way or the other about. Which, when I thought about it for long enough, made sense, worryingly. With that in mind, we added a semi-retired mechanic called Dennis, who offered us taxi service in his Ford Zodiac, whom our mother also hated. I wondered if it might be simpler just to instigate a reunion with our father, who she hated. My sister disagreed. In her opinion, they were still chalk and cheese. Also, he'd begun to fade as a notion. It was the way with divorced fathers in those days. They tended to keep out of the picture from sheer politeness and convenience. Ditto non-divorced fathers, actually, except with divorced ones, you actually never saw them, except for the odd Sunday lunch or to trudge across a field with a picnic. They were absent from your private life, and this was hard on the leftover boys like little Jack, because there was no man at home to show them how to make the noise of an explosion or to tell them that West Germany were better than Ecuador. Not that our particular father would have been able to do either of those, but it was the principle of the thing. And worse than that, they were absent from your public life, never attending parents' evenings or sports days or school plays, and never seeing nature displays or topic books. They never saw you perform, excel, try, succeed, fail. And this was hard on my sister because it meant he never got to hear about her extraordinary cleverness in school and therefore couldn't possibly admire her as much as he should. She did occasionally tell him about it, but it always sounded boastful and far-fetched and it sickened all concerned, so she stopped. I was the least bothered by our father's private and public absence, probably because I was certain he'd have been a fine father if it hadn't been for the divorce. I somehow didn't need his reminders to save lolly sticks in case of a sudden urge to make a model of Leicester Prison, as he'd done as a boy, albeit with matchsticks. I had a good memory and I'd heard plenty of his advice on life. Neither did I need his seal of approval. I just happened to think that, compared with everyone else on offer, he was the nicest and the best and, more importantly, the wellest known. He remained on the man list, theoretically, but, before you get any ideas, there never was a romantic remarriage. There wasn't even a tryout. We decided it was just all too tangled and unlikely, not to mention the travel.
Nina Stibbe, reading an extract from her book Man at the Helm, which is out now. Do you remember Don Tillman, the lovable genetics professor from Melbourne, who found his perfect match in The Rosie Project? Well, he's back in The Rosie Effect, approaching fatherhood and getting up to his usual tricks of research.
To solve the immediate nutrition problem, I selected a vegetarian recipe at random from one of the websites. A jog via Trader Joe's sufficed to source all the necessary ingredients for a tofu and squash flan. I was left with an afternoon of unscheduled time, an ideal opportunity to do some research in line with Jean's advice. It seemed wise to delay the shower and change until after my excursion, especially as the weather forecast indicated a 30% probability of rain. I put my light raincoat on over my jogging costume and added a cycling hat for hair protection. There was a small playground on 10th Avenue, only a few blocks away. It was perfect. I was able to sit on a bench alone and watch children with their guardians. Binoculars would have been helpful, but I could observe gross motor actions and even hear some conversation, especially as much of it was shouted. I was not disturbed. In fact, on the sole occasion that a child approached me, it was immediately summoned back. I made several observations in my notebook. The children explored for short distances, but routinely checked and returned to their guardians. I recalled seeing a documentary in which this behaviour was made more obvious by fast motion replay, but could not recall what type of animal was involved. My phone had substantial available memory, so I began shooting my own video. Jean would definitely be interested. My recording was interrupted by some kind of communal activity. The guardians and children gathered together for approximately 20 seconds and then moved to the other end of the playground, where my view of them was obscured by a central island of foliage. I followed and sat where I could observe them again, but they did not resume their play. I decided to wait and use the time to change the video resolution on my phone in case there was an opportunity to film a longer segment. Due to my focus on the camera operating task, I did not notice the approach of two uniformed male police officers. In retrospect, I may not have handled the situation well, but it was an unfamiliar social protocol and unexpected circumstances driven by rules which I did not know. I was also struggling with the video application, which I had downloaded because of its superior compression algorithm, without due attention to its user friendliness. "What do you think you're doing?" This was the marginally older policeman. I guess they were both in their 30s and in good physical shape. Body mass index is approximately 23. "I think I'm configuring the resolution, but it's possible I'm doing something different. It's unlikely you will be able to assist unless you're familiar with the application." "Well, I guess we should just get out of your way and leave you with the kids." "Excellent. Good luck fighting crime." "Get up." This was an unexpected change of attitude on the part of the younger colleague. Perhaps I was seeing a demonstration of the good cop, bad cop protocol. I looked to good cop to see if I would receive contrary instructions. "Do you also require me to stand up?" Good cop assisted me to stand. Forcefully. My dislike of being touched is visceral, and my response was similarly automatic. I did not pin or throw my assailant, but I did use a simple Aikido move to disengage and distance him from me. He staggered back and bad cop pulled his gun. Good cop produced handcuffs. At the police station, the officers sought a statement in which I conceded that I had been in the park observing children and that I had resisted arrest. I was finally given an answer to the obvious question. What had I done wrong? It is illegal in New York to enter a designated children's playground without the company of a child under the age of 12. Apparently there was a sign posted on the fence to that effect. Incredible. If I had actually been, as presumably suspected by the police and anticipated by the lawmakers, someone who gained sexual satisfaction from observing children, I would have had to kidnap a child in order to gain entry to the playground. Good cop and bad cop were not interested in this argument, and I eventually provided an account of events that seemed to satisfy them. I was then left alone in a small room for 54 minutes. My phone had been confiscated. At that point, an older man, also in uniform, joined me, carrying what I guessed was the printed version of my statement. "Professor Tillman? Greetings. I need to call a lawyer." The time spent alone had been useful in allowing me to collect my thoughts. I remembered a 1-800 phone number for criminal lawyers from a Subway advertisement. "You don't want to call your wife first?" "My priority is professional advice." I was also conscious that news of my arrest would cause Rosie stress, particularly as the problem was still unresolved and she could do little to help. "You can call a lawyer if you want. Maybe you won't need one." "You want something to drink?" My answer was automatic. "Yes, please. Tequila, straight up."
Graham Simsion, reading an extract from his book, The Rosie Effect, which is out now. Finally, hugely successful author Nick Hornby, who's had many literary successes with his books from About a Boy to High Fidelity, returns with a brand new book about a golden age of British television comedy. In this interview, he starts by providing us with the plot of Funny Girl.
Well, the plot is, most of the book is the birth, life and death of a fictional sitcom. And as you say, the creative people who are responsible for it. There were lots of things that inspired it. I think, you know, partly my own experience over the last few years doing screenwriting and being part of a creative team and wanting to write about the pleasures and perils of collaborative work. I was interested in the period after an education. Television comedy is something I've always really loved. So all these things kind of gelled together.
So you mentioned an education in the period setting. You've never actually written a novel with a period setting before. So how was that particularly a different experience? And did your research in an education, how did that kind of feed into your writing process for this one?
Well, I think because I was used to thinking about the period and thinking about dialogue in the period, and in fact, an education I think ends in 1964, which is the year that Funny Girl starts. So in some ways, it's sort of the next
natural progression.
Yes, the next instalment in a story. I was also really influenced in lots of ways by David Kynaston, the social historian. I just read all of those books, Austerity and Family and Modernity Britain. So even though he hasn't yet quite reached the time that I'm writing about in the book, it was, you know, I'd spent a long time thinking about that era of British history, and all my characters will have grown up through that time. So I think that informed the book too.
So the social history aspect of things in the book, the attitudes of in the period towards women and towards homosexuality are explored, and it's kind of implied in quite a lot of your work that you feel quite strongly that pop culture is a good way of exploring these quite difficult, complicated subjects. So was that kind of a motivation behind writing this, kind of exploring those areas, or were you primarily about telling the story and exploring the entertainment side of things?
Well, I think recently I've got more and more interested in all forms of art and how it's made. So I don't necessarily make the decision between, or the distinction between popular culture and high culture, it's just culture. Of course, there is stuff in the book about the division between popular culture and high culture, and there's certainly a critic, a couple of other people who are sort of anti the work that these people do. But for the most part, it's just a way of writing about how we're driven to create art and about writing. But yes, the thing about those comedy programs at the time, they had such huge audiences that they were a very powerful tool for all sorts of things.
Sophie Straw, you've mentioned, was inspired by Lucille Ball, and you've also said that you don't think that England had a kind of equivalent to Lucille Ball at that time. Why do you think that is? Do you think it was a cultural thing, or was Lucy just a genuine one-off?
I think it's possible that Lucy was a one-off, actually. And her career was extraordinary because becoming a sitcom star was almost her last throw of the dice. She'd been in lots of movies in the 30s, 40s. I think she was probably in her 40s. Certainly late 30s when she started with the Lucy Show. And she'd sort of failed as a romantic lead. So I think a lot of things conspired to make her a TV star that were probably not intentional on her part or on anyone else's. But once she got there, she was this incredible inspiration and influence to generation after generation of American comedians. One of the things that struck me, whenever you see an interview with anyone from the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s onwards, they always talk about how Lucille Ball influenced them and that they watch those reruns all the time. And I think we have felt the lack of it here. We're getting up to speed now, but it's very hard to think of an English comedian of a similar stature from the 60s or 70s.
So do you think American comedy has generally had an edge on British comedy in the last few years, or is it specifically around funny women that were kind of, you think, might have been lagging a bit behind?
Well, I think in England we always venerate American television, American drama and American comedy, but they do a bit of that as well.
Yeah.
I think, with Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and The Office, of course the big difference with our comedy is that the series are always so short. There were only ever 12 episodes of Fawlty Towers, whereas something like Seinfeld went on for 9 years, 10 years with 16 or however many episodes each series. So
do you think that's kind of conducive to building the characters, that having that longer period of time to let them bed in and kind of get to know them, and that's
yes,
a different kind of comedy?
It is a different kind of comedy, and I think the Americans don't understand why we let our writers off the hook. If you've got a big show, then you've got to keep writing it.
Yeah.
And of course there are advantages, absolutely, to being able to explore characters year after year after year.
Nick Hornby, talking about his new book, Funny Girl. And now, an extract from the audiobook.
Brian sent Sophie Straw up for a part as a young housewife in a soap commercial. She was pretty sure that he was trying to break her spirit. She'd spent the evening listening to Brian's elocution records on Marjorie's record player and practising her best Jean Metcalf voice, but this time they stopped her even before she was asked to speak. A man from the soap manufacturers was sitting in the room with the director, and he smiled and shook his head. "I'm sorry, Sophie," said the director, "not this time." "Can I ask why not?" The man from the soap manufacturers whispered into the director's ear, and the director shrugged. "He says you're nobody's idea of a housewife. You're too pretty, and your shape is all wrong." "What's wrong with my shape?" The soap man laughed. "Nothing," he said. "That's what's wrong with it. We're looking for something a little mumsier." She remembered the mayor of Blackpool. "Kiddies in cream buns, kiddies in cream buns." "I could have just got married recently," she said. And once again she was sickened by her own hunger. She should have walked out, tipped the table over, spat at them. Instead she was begging. "It's an advertisement for soap, darling. We haven't got time to explain how long you've been married and where you met your husband and how you're still watching your figure." "Thanks for coming in anyway," said the director. "I'll certainly remember you if I'm doing something that's a better match." "What would that be?" she asked. "Oh, you know, a glamorous drink, baby sham, Dubonnet, that sort of thing. Maybe cigarettes. Something that isn't, you know, the opposite of you." "I'm the opposite of soap." "Oh, no, I'm sure you're lovely and clean. You're the opposite of domestic, though, aren't you?" "Am I?" "Are you married, Sophie?" "Well, no, but I think I could pretend to be married for 2 minutes in a soap advertisement." "I'll walk you out," said the soap man. The director smiled to himself and shook his head gently. When they were out of earshot, the soap man asked her out to dinner. He was wearing a wedding ring, of course.
Emma Fielding, reading an extract from the audiobook edition of Funny Girl, which is out now. And that's it from the Penguin Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes for future podcast episodes and head to SoundCloud for other author readings and audiobook extracts at www.soundcloud.com/penguin-books. To find out more about the authors and books featured in this episode, visit the website thepenguinpodcast.co.uk, and if you have any comments or suggestions, you can find us on Twitter at Penguin Audio.
You've been listening to the Penguin Podcast.